from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
I'm Rick Howlett, and this is In Conversation. It's our Kentucky Derby and Kentucky Oaks preview show. The COVID restrictions at the racetrack have been lifted, and for the first time since 2019, Churchill Downs is expected to be at full capacity for the races. Today, we'll set the scene for the Oaks and Derby and get some predictions from handicappers Ed DeRosa and Emily Gullickson. Later, we'll talk with historian and author Emily Bingham. She's just published a book on the history of Kentucky's state song, My Old Kentucky Home, which for decades has been played and sung just before the Kentucky Derby, a tradition some say should come to an end. It's all ahead this hour on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Well, here we are on another Kentucky Derby Eve and Kentucky Oaks Day as racing fans and revelers gather at the track or at home parties to celebrate the 148th consecutive running of both races. Today on the show, we'll preview the Oaks and Derby and talk about what's been going on in the thoroughbred racing world. There's been a lot in the last few years. And joining us today is our panel of two distinguished experts. Emily Gullickson is a horse player and partner at OpticsEQ.com, which she describes as a premier handicapping information provider. One of her primary roles at OpticsEQ is taking detailed trip notes and being a specialist in form cycle analysis. And in a minute, I'll ask her what that means. Her work is featured regularly at Brisnet and Twin Spires. Those are Churchill Downs properties. And she was featured on the Ringer podcast series, Gamblers, the Punk Rock Horse Player. Emily, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. We can't have a racing show without Ed DeRosa. He's a Cleveland native who got into racing going to Thistledown with his grandfather after 9 years as a reporter and editor with Thoroughbred Times and 10 years with Churchill Downs Incorporated as a director of marketing. Ed is back to his media roots as vice president of content and product development at Horse Racing Nation. And in his bio, he lists a couple of his favorite horses, which I'll come back to later when I talk about those. Ed DeRosa, welcome back to In Conversation.
Glad to be back. Excited for a full-fledged Derby weekend this year in Louisville.
Yeah, a lot of folks are excited about that. Full capacity this year. Later in the program, we're going to be joined by Emily Bingham. This is a conversation we actually had earlier in the week. She has just published a book this week called My Old Kentucky Home, The Astonishing Life and Reckoning of an Iconic American Song, which, of course, is a Kentucky state song and is played just prior and sung just prior to the Kentucky Derby. Emily will join us later in the program. So, Emily, back to your introduction. You talk about form cycle analysis. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're looking for horses, especially when they're coming into the race, is are they coming into it looking to perform at their best effort? So we know horses are not machines. Athletes are not machines. We even as people have good days, bad days for whatever reason. And following these horses since the beginning of the career and how they're coming into the race is important to know why they're running a good race, why they're running a bad race, what kind of time they prefer between starts, how they're doing from race to race. And that's really form cycle analysis. It's a subjective area, and it does take a lot of work and a lot of visual cues from watching the horses race.
Ed, tell us before we get started about Horse Racing Nation. This is something new for you, right?
Yeah, just started after Breeders' Cup, so I've been there about 6 months, and it's a content site, some news, some handicapping stuff, some data, which is hopefully where I come in, create some new products for horse players to complement the great stuff Emily and her team does with Optics. But it's a data-rich sport, and if you want to get ahead in it, you need to look at it a little differently than the competition. So that's part of what we're hoping to do at Horse Racing Nation.
Well, the past several Kentucky Derbies have been eventful beyond just the what goes on during the race, the excitement of the race. Going back to 2019, pre-pandemic, maximum security, disqualified by stewards for veering into the path of other horses, Country House declared the winner. 2020, of course, the pandemic is upon us. The race was postponed until September. There were no paying spectators in the stands. There were racial justice protests outside the track. Authentic was and still the winner. And then in 2021, last year, Medina Spirit failed a drug test for a banned race day substance. Has been disqualified. Bob Baffert was suspended by Churchill Downs and also got a shorter suspension from the State Racing Commission, facing disciplinary action in other states. So, Ed, I guess my question is, it's pretty obvious that Churchill is hoping for a clean race and clean drug test all around, but fans and bettors are hoping not to have any confusion this year, right?
Yeah, I would say we're all simpatico on that, wherever you fall on the Baffert debate. You want a clean race, a clean trip, a safe trip, certainly most importantly, and then you want a fair shake. Whether you're an owner, trainer, horseman, or gambler, you want to know that what you put your money and time and sweat into was fair. And whenever these things come back positive, that comes into question and, you know, really affects the whole industry. So we're all hoping for a great couple of days of racing on and off the track in the days after testing wise.
Well, Baffert was, of course, conspicuous by his presence, the white hair and sunglasses, big personality, and he's conspicuous by his absence this year. Medina Spirit would have been his seventh Derby victory. He's had two Triple Crowns, of course, and he's, again, conspicuous by his absence this year. But is his hand still felt, Ed, at the track? He was training some horses that have gone over to other trainers for the Derby, right?
Yeah, it's impossible to ignore his presence or lack thereof. Two of his former trainees, Messier and Taiba, are now trained by Tim Yakteen, who has had some association with Bob in the past. He's now the trainer of record. The owners are the same, and the owner of Taiba is the same as Medina Spirit. So certainly if he were to win that trophy presentation with the owner of Medina Spirit and Churchill Downs CEO Bill Carstensen would be very interesting indeed. But yeah, his presence is felt. All that said, I will say it's a little less than I was expecting. I've been out at the track all week. It's certainly a talking point. People have mentioned it, but it's definitely not this paw. I think it has shown that Churchill made the right move and that the Derby is bigger than anything, including Bob Baffert.
Emily, do you think this all this controversy with involving Baffert, has it had a negative effect on fans, on bettors, with their enthusiasm for the sport?
You know, to take it kind of a bigger picture than just Baffert itself, I think it's a kind of a turning point for the sport just in general. And I think a lot of sports are kind of feeling this just with a lot of the social pressure and social impacts of the direction of where horse racing wants to go and certain changes that have needed to be made for a long time and have just been, you've been able to kind of get away with not addressing them. And it does just kind of bring into the forefront, we do have to address these issues, and hopefully that's being taken care of.
Ed, do you see Baffert coming back and resuming his career at Churchill Downs?
Yeah, I do. Just, you know, based on what we've seen, he's really fought this. I agree with Dwayne Lucas, some of the comments he's made this week. If Baffert had just taken his medicine, so to speak, you know, it's terrible for the sport to have, you know, any horse in this situation, let alone the Derby winner. But, you know, I think he could have reached an agreement where maybe he was gone for a year. This really, really blew up because he dug in his heels, but I do think he'll be back. It just seems, you know, whether you want to attribute it to ego or his owners want who they consider the best or a combination thereof, it just doesn't seem like he's going to go away.
Well, let's talk about the effect of the pandemic on tracks and wagering. Emily, has it, obviously there were fewer people at the track to put down bets, but did that really boost online betting in your experience?
Well, we've seen the handle, just, you know, what it is. But from my own anecdotal experience, I was at a sports betting conference in April out in Las Vegas, and I met a lot of people that are not regular horse players that are sports bettors, but shifted to taking a look at horse racing and getting involved in the horse racing pools during the pandemic when other sports weren't available. So I think that did open the eyes to a lot of people that, you know, horse racing is around. It is a viable gambling option. So it is kind of an interesting interest, and I think some new people have been brought into the game.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're talking about the Kentucky Derby and the Kentucky Oaks, and we have our two panel of two experts with us. Emily Gullickson, whose voice you just heard, is a horse player and partner at OpticsEQ.com. Ed DeRosa is with us. He is Vice President of Content and Product Development at Horse Racing Nation. Ed, has the pandemic had a bigger effect on smaller tracks? Did some not survive it?
Not to be glib, but unfortunately, the two tracks that haven't survived are both owned by Churchill Downs because they sold Calder and Arlington, and that's not pandemic related. They just felt like the tracks were worth more as a sales piece than they were as operating them as racetracks. The small tracks within the pandemic did great because the ones that stayed open were the only game in town or one of the few games in town on certain days. Fonner Park in Nebraska and Will Rogers Downs in Oklahoma in particular did millions of dollars in handle a day, whereas usually it's maybe $500,000. So it was, always hate to use the word great when talking about something pandemic related, but they did very well and it kind of put them on the map, so to speak. And, you know, they haven't retained nearly as much of that money as I'm sure they'd like, but people recognize them now, and I'd say it was good for them. For whatever reason, here in Kentucky, now that we're back to full strength, pretty much Keeneland obliterated its handle records in April, and Churchill Downs so far this week is way up on its handle versus last year. They were double on Thurby. I'm expecting record handle this weekend.
And Churchill Downs has made, I know there were plans for a hotel there on the Churchill Downs property, and then that was scrapped during the pandemic. But they've announced plans for some other development, right? There are really a big reconfiguration of the paddock area.
Yeah, the paddock's going to get a full redo for the Sesquicentennial Derby 150 in 2024, and they're building a historical racing facility, basically slot machines, in downtown Louisville. So there's certainly investment in the flagship properties here in Louisville. I do wish they would have held on to Arlington near Emily's home.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about racing. We're going to talk about the Kentucky Oaks and Kentucky Derby with Ed DeRosa, you just heard there, and Emily Gullickson. We'll be back with much more in a moment. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Now the tempo starting to quicken as they move toward the top of the stretch. Here's Rachel Alexandra, who takes the lead. Rachel Alexandra takes the lead just outside the quarter pole. She did it willingly and really had no resistance whatsoever from Gabby's Golden Bat. And now Rachel Alexandra's opening up. Five lengths on the field. Six. Oh, a tour de force by the super filly, Rachel Alexandra. Kevin Burrell isn't moving a muscle on her. She's going to destroy this field. Oh, super filly, you bet. What's the final margin? She might have won by 20. Rachel Alexandra was absolutely spectacular in 1:48.45. Stone Legacy was well beaten in second, and finishing third there was Flying Spur. Unbelievable.
And that was the great Tom Durkin with the call of the 2009 Kentucky Oaks, won, of course, by Rachel Alexandra. And we are talking about the Oaks and Kentucky Derby, previewing the races here on In Conversation on WFPL. Our guests today are Emily Gullickson from OpticsEQ.com and Ed DeRosa, who is Vice President of Content and Product Development at Horse Racing Nation. And Ed, going back to your bio, you list you have two favorite horses. Rachel Alexandra is one of them, and really a spectacular filly. I can see why you chose that one.
Yeah, that was one of those moments, and there really haven't been that many at that level. Watching that race and her draw off to win by 20, and I've saved the text actually all the way back to 2009, texted a couple people and said that was unbelievable, and I called it a grandkid moment, because that's just one of those races I'm going to be telling future generations about until I go to the great beyond. And I feel very fortunate that I got to see that live, because that was as good as a performance as I think you could ever expect to see.
I forgot. Why didn't Rachel Alexandra run in the Kentucky Derby?
You know, she wasn't even nominated at the time. Her owner was Dolphus Morrison, and he was actually very bullish about this. He said that the Derby, the classic races, our Triple Crown races, are for making stallions. And he wanted to run fillies against fillies and let the stallions be made stallions. Ironically, a gelding won the Derby that year, so there was no stallion to be made. She absolutely could have won the Kentucky Derby that year, but we saw her be spectacular in the Oaks, and then he sold her to Jess Jackson, Stone Street Farm, Kendall Jackson Winery, for $10 million, and he wheeled her right back in the Preakness with Steve Asmussen, and she won from post 13. So I know, you know, in the time, it's easy to get lost up in these great horses, but I really think she's an all-timer and maybe the best three-year-old filly ever.
And briefly, your other favorite horse, not a Derby horse, Ghost Zapper.
That's right. Yeah, he won the Breeders' Cup at Lone Star in 04, and he was just one of those horses that the brilliant raw talent just could not be denied watching him. And I rank him right below Spectacular Bid in terms of some of the best that have ever run.
Well, I have to give you a chance, Emily, before we get into the Oaks. Are there favorite horses of yours that stick out?
Oh, sure. Now, I'll kind of keep it in the same era as Rachel Alexandra. Zenyatta was running around the same time, and she's one of my favorites. A different running style. She came from behind, closed from off the pace, so a lot of drama with her run. And also just watching her race, I was there when she won the Vanity at Hollywood Park. Hollywood Park, another one of those defunct CDI former establishments. But that entire place was packed. And it's so rare to be at a sporting event and you have almost the entire place cheering for one athlete. It's really just an incredible moment. That place was shaking. The woman next to me, just a stranger, just hugged me. It was just very emotional. And, you know, horse racing just has those excellent moments that you'll never forget.
Well, let's talk about the 148th Kentucky Oaks. We have a field, lost my place here. We have a field of 15, Ed. Nest listed as the early favorite. Who do you like?
I like Kathleen O, and I believe we're officially at the point where number 15 is out. So we're down to the 14. No one scratched to let the 15 in. And I like Kathleen O, similar to Zenyatta. She has a come-from-behind style. That's probably where the comparisons end for now. Zenyatta, on all-timer, Kathleen O, undefeated, but still needs to win a big one. This could be it. I am a little concerned, and this is more Emily's with what she does with Optic, so I'm curious to hear what she says. I'm a little concerned about how much pace is going to come back to her. So as a closer, that's the big concern with her, is if the race will come back to her enough to reward her for her furious kick. But at 4-1, which I think is the price she'll be, I'll pay to find out.
Emily, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ed actually kind of summarized it, that it really just, with a come from behind horse, and when you do have some questions, it comes down to what price you find acceptable. She's certainly capable. I mean, Ed mentioned 4-for-4, but one of the faster fillies in this field by our numbers at Optics EQ, a strong closing kick. She's shown a lot of class in her races. So she's certainly one of the ones that if she won would be no surprise. This race as a whole is just very competitive. There's tons of talent. I don't think there'd be few surprises in this field, to be honest. Nest is the listed favorite. I think she opened up as the favorite in this race, and she could certainly win. I'm not as strong as her as a lot of the public and the way people feel that she's the clear-cut horse to beat. I think this race is very competitive. Kathleen O would be no surprise. I'm going to kind of go outside the box a little bit, looking at number 2, Nostalgic, one a filly that's on the improve, a progressive type. She showed some class early on. She actually ran against Nest as a juvenile, and since then, she's just progressed race to race. She she's already proven at the distance and has been able to kind of alter her running style to sit up closer to softer paces when necessary. I just think she's coming into this race at the right time. And then I'm also going to give a look to a longer shot, a stablemate to Nest, number 13, Shahama, a filly that hasn't run in the United States. She won the prep out in Dubai during the Maidan Carnival and was very impressive that day and actually in all of her race, another undefeated type. And just watching her work, she just shows a lot of class in her works. And I like her determination and the fit with the rider, Flavian Pratt. I just think that's a great combination. She does have that hurdle to overcome, but again, should be a longer price to compensate.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're talking about the Kentucky Derby and Kentucky Oaks with Emily Gullickson from OpticsEQ.com and Ed DeRosa with Horse Racing Nation. You just heard their picks for the Kentucky Oaks. Those of you listening to our repeat or our podcast later on, those picks will either be very brilliant or you are wondering what were they talking about. We'll see what happens. Well, let's talk about the Kentucky Derby. And I bring this question up every year, Ed. There's a full field of 20, which is that too many in your view? Because usually a field is roughly half that, right?
Yeah, I would say day to day, most tracks will be thrilled with fields of half that. I think the average is between 8 and 9 day to day, and stakes races might even be a little less. So this is definitely an outlier for a number of reasons, but the Derby being 20, certainly among them. The most you'll see in any other race typically is 14. The Belmont's limited to 16. I don't even know if they've ever had 16 in the Belmont. So 20 is different and unique. I definitely think that's part of what makes it special. I understand it wouldn't overly hurt my feelings if it were 18. But from a business standpoint, as a 10-year employee of Churchill Downs, I've certainly heard the spiel. 20 horses, the amount of combinations that creates in all the wagers and the handle 20 horses generates versus 19 or 18 is substantial. It actually contributes, you know, in those 2-minute race, contributes to the bottom line of the company. And for that reason, I just can't see them going less than 20.
What do you think, Emily? I look through this field and there's, you know, for the better, I look through this field and there's several that I like, but there's just so many to choose from. What do you think about a field of 20?
Yeah, I mean, I like it for, you know, one, Ed mentioned the logistics of why they're running it. And I think just because this is a big race and as we know, horses only have one chance to run the Derby. It's only open to 3-year-old runners. So to allow as many participants that opportunity as possible, given it is one chance, if it came down to a safety issue, then I would say we need to go less than 20, but it doesn't seem that really makes a difference at this point. But as you mentioned, it is a very competitive race this year. There are a lot of ways to go. It does kind of take some decision-making, some eliminations to kind of come up with a decision.
Well, before we get your picks, I want to talk about post position. There was a draw for the post position earlier this week for both races. Ed, does a bad post position, would that necessarily make you change your mind about a horse that you've picked that you really like?
You know, it probably should, to be honest. But one of the unique things about the Derby is we've been handicapping this race for months and certainly been digging in for weeks, and for better or worse psychologically, I do get married to the horses I find myself gravitating toward. So, you know, if I'm being honest, I would say it probably wouldn't affect how I approach the race. But if you're on a stone cold gate to wire type, need the lead, I wouldn't be thrilled with 1, 2, 19, or 20. If you're a mid pack that has, you know, maybe a sweeping move, I probably wouldn't love the far outside either because I'd be worried about getting caught wide early. But other than that, it's 20 horses. It's a mile and a quarter. It's 150,000 people. There's already enough uncertainty. The post isn't going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
What do you think about that, Emily? I mean, can a good horse overcome a bad post position?
Yeah, I mean, to really echo what Ed's saying, there's so much that goes on in a 20 horse field to really break it down, so to speak, in terms of the one factor that kept this horse from winning was the post position. Just seems so much of a reach. There's so many things that can happen. Running styles play a bigger role, in my opinion, to the post itself. How, as like Ed said, how a horse can run from a certain position, the hurdles that they have to overcome, the horses to their left and right can sometimes be an even bigger factor than the actual draw itself.
Well, let's get some picks here. Emily, I'll let you go first. Who do you like?
I'm going to go on with the rail horse, which I know will kind of scare some people away, with number one, Mo Donegal, just a horse that's been very progressive throughout his races, going back to his debut, a horse that looked like he was going to stretch out and appreciate and improve with the added ground. And he's done just that. And there's really nothing to knock with his races this season. Now he does have to get a trip as he's coming from off the pace. So require some racing luck. But outside of that, just really checks all the boxes, coming into the race the right way and getting a little bit of value because of that post position. I'm also upgrading number seven, Crown Pride, another one that's just a little bit unknown because this will be the first start in the US, but another horse that has some ability. The intention has been here to run at this race. He's been on the grounds training probably more than any other horse coming into this race, and one I'm excited to see run on Saturday.
I think the early favorite is Zandon. Your thoughts, Emily, on the favorite?
Yeah, I think Zandon is very legit. Really, my only knock is the fact that he is listed as the favorite. While he is a super good horse, I don't think he has any strong edge over some of the other horses in this field to make the favorite and to take a short price. He's definitely a horse I'm going to be using. I don't have any knocks outside of that shorter expected price.
Ed, who do you like?
I'm swinging for the fences in this one. I like Tis the Bomb, number 9, 30-1 on the morning line. There's some legitimate concerns regarding whether he is a dirt horse or not. And if he's not, he has very little chance in this race. But it's a gambling game, and I think 30-1 is worth the gamble because based on the Jeff Ruby stakes up at Turfway, which he won 5 or 6 weeks ago, that type of performance, I do think, is good enough to win this race. So I'm willing to bet that it transfers to the Churchill Downs main track. The late, great John Asher always said that of all main tracks, Churchill's is the kindest to turf. So hoping for a little luck from John this week and a big price in the Derby.
Well, I was going to ask you to pick a favorite long shot, and that's so you are swinging for the fences. Emily, going back to the some of the long shots in the field here, is there one that sticks out to you that would might be good to take a chance on?
Well, I think Crown Pride will be his morning line is 20-1. I think he'll be around there just for some of the unknown factors. So I'd be willing to land there. I don't think there's any of the long shots necessarily that I'm keying on in the win spot, but certainly some longer shots that can run fill underneath.
Ed, let me ask you about the trainers, because every year there are usually one, two, or three trainers that have multiple horses that they've trained in the race. And I'm wondering from an owner's point of view, what does that mean to an? I would be, if I was an owner, I'd be a little concerned if my trainer had more than one horse that they may favor one over the other. But apparently, that's not an issue. I mean, what's that dynamic like?
Yeah, I don't know so much if it's not an issue. I do think within race to race, some of these trainers definitely, I don't want to. Auto racing seems maybe too much of a reach, but Chad Brown will talk to you when he sends multiple horses out. He definitely has a plan of where he wants each of his horses. And the thought is, this is how it works out best to give my barn the best chance of winning, is if these horses run in this way. Owners do know they're signing up for that, though. There's no hoodwinking when it comes to that. So, at least I think you're getting a fair shake. You know what you're getting. As much respect as I do have for the Chad Browns and Asmussens and Pletchers of the world, I don't think they're that much better that they deserve all these horses. Hopefully I'm in a position one day, maybe if Tis the Bomb wins, that I can spread the love a little bit more, because there's some great horsemen out there that don't get the chance because, people go with the designer name. But I do think they strategize with same horses in the race. But I also think that the owners know that's what they're getting. And I would say that's even part of the draw in some cases, because when they have a really good one, they know they're going to get the best chance.
Emily, which trainer is due for a Derby victory that hasn't won one yet? Who's the best or the most deserving that you expect to win one before it's said and done?
You know, I mean, that's such a tough question. I mean, they all work hard, show up every day, and you know, it's really, really the horse themselves that are going to have to speak into this race. You know, I'll bring up Crown Pride one more time. I think it would be probably pretty exciting just for the world of horse racing for Japan to win a Derby, not necessarily that they're due or they're more deserving of anybody else. I think everybody in this field is certainly deserving in their own right.
And Ed, before we go, I think you wanted to mention something about Ronald McDonald House.
Yeah, I saw her coming in with the underwriting and the bumper. I spent 5.5 months there. So it's a really great organization, and certainly encourage anyone who's looking for a place for some help that they know it's going to the right place. I experienced it firsthand.
Well, we thank you for passing that along, and thank you both for joining us. We're just about out of time. Emily picks number one in the Derby, Mo Donegal, and Ed's going out on a limb a little bit. Tis the Bomb, his pick to win the Derby, and as they say, we'll see what happens when they line up Saturday evening at Churchill Downs. Thank you both very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you with us. And after a break, we're going to talk with Emily Bingham. It's a conversation we had earlier this week, and talk about her new book about Kentucky's state song, and that has met with more controversy in recent years. And there's questions about whether it should be played and sung before the Kentucky Derby, as it has since about 1930. We'll talk to Emily about her book, My Old Kentucky Home, The Astonishing Life and Reckoning of an Iconic American Song, after a break. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the Kentucky Derby will be run for the 148th consecutive year Saturday, and for almost a century of that now, the race has been preceded by another tradition, the playing and singing of My Old Kentucky Home. Stephen Foster's composition from the 1850s about a slave lamenting his forced departure from a Kentucky plantation to the sugarcane fields of the Deep South is Kentucky's state song, celebrated and performed around the world, but remains troubling, to say the least, to many people. They say even though it may have been intended as an anti-slavery song and the lyrics have been softened, it's still a constant reminder of oppression and white supremacy. The debate over the song has intensified, of course, recently amid the racial justice protests that erupted following the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others at the hands of police. So for the past several years, Emily Bingham has been exploring the history of My Old Kentucky Home, the song, and what a history it has. She's written a book about it called My Old Kentucky Home, The Astonishing Life and Reckoning of an Iconic American Song. It's published by Knopf. Emily is here. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks so much, Rick. I'm delighted to be with you.
It is great to have you. We've been looking forward to this book. And we should disclose that Emily and her family are generous financial supporters of public media in general and of Louisville Public Media specifically. So what a journey the song has been on, the song many of us have sung at the Kentucky Derby, University of Kentucky games, or other events. It evokes a general love and longing for the place, you know, we call home, Kentucky. And you have a quote from the great sports writer Frank DeFord in your book. He says, I'm paraphrasing, it's a moment when beauty and history bisect. But the original ballad, as you write, tells a much sadder story of slavery, and the song is much different, was much different back then than it is what we sing today. So take us back. What prompted Stephen Foster to write this tune back in the 1850s?
Well, it's really important, I think, to dial back to the 1850s and 1840s when Stephen Foster was becoming a professional songwriter, one of the first maybe ever in this country, and he was steeped in something called blackface minstrelsy. It was the dominant genre, musical genre, performance genre, theatrical genre of the era. And it was really America's first great cultural invention slash export, because we were a new nation that didn't have a lot of our own cultural kind of styles that we were copying a lot. So he, though, was a man from Pittsburgh, also really important. This wasn't something that originated in the South. Blackface minstrelsy didn't, and neither did this song, which was a blackface minstrel song. But that genre was one in which white men, including Stephen Foster himself as a little boy, blacked up their faces and performed songs about black people, mostly enslaved people, also free people, making fun of them, caricaturing, stereotyping them, for the entertainment of white people. So this is what he was doing. He was a prolific songwriter, but most of his songs did not earn him very much money at all, whereas the ones that were in this genre, like Oh Susanna, Camp Town Races, Old Folks at Home, Old Uncle Ned, Old Dog Tray, these were songs that he mastered the art of writing popular melodies about black people that were entertaining and went wildly popular, sung before, you know, royalty, presidents in the White House, and all over cities, towns, and eventually villages across the nation. And the South was really a very small part of that. It was an inauthentic portrait of blackness of that era.
And was he aware of that? We always hear the correlation with Uncle Tom's Cabin. Do we know if he had read the book, or he was at least aware of it?
You could not be alive in 1852 and not be aware of Harriet Beecher Stowe's monumental bestseller, Uncle Tom's Cabin. And only in the 1930s, I mean, the song, if you just, I encourage anybody to look up the original lyrics to My Old Kentucky Home of 1853 as published. Please take 2 moments and read them. But he wrote, we know from his archival notebook that was rediscovered by historians in the 1930s, that he wrote an early draft of this song, which is very similar, and it was called Old Uncle Tom Goodnight. It's different. It uses more slurs and more racial slurs, and also more, quote, dialect, that this was very common in blackface minstrel songs. And it, even more clearly than the song that was ultimately published, ties into the novel. He made a decision to uncouple the song from so directly from that novel. And I think that decision was a considered economic, rational business decision, which was he knew how popular that song was. I mean, that book was, but he was worried. Most people in the United States were not anti-slavery. Even mm-hmm. if they read the book, they were not anti-slavery. And he needed to capture the broadest audience he could.
The thing that strikes me about these minstrel songs is that it gave white people used them to not only appropriate skin color, which I think you have a quote from a black person saying they're taking our skin color too, but they also appropriated their misery in a way, you know, because they wanted to feel that sadness at least briefly without actually having to go through the suffering itself.
This was one of the most profound elements to me of learning about and sitting with, for as long as I did, this song, which has been ringing in my head, you can imagine, for
yes.
Thousands of nights at this point. But the idea, the fundamental way it operated economically and emotionally, sort of the emotional economy of it, is that it used black pain to wring white tears. And William Makepeace Thackeray, the British author, had a quote about his experience in the Blackface Minstrel Show, seeing Blackface Minstrel Show in America. And he said it was the most exultant experience. And he used the words happy pity. These two things together, happy pity about this people, this group of people, this population within. And look, this is just the way America was. This wasn't specially racist people. We just, and I'm just asking us to sit with that and try to understand where this has come from and how a song that was that and was known to be that kept being folded into our cultural DNA so that it has been literally enshrined, passed down with love, unknowingly, not with evil intent. That's the way systems of race and discrimination and pain have been reproduced.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio, and we are talking to Emily Bingham. Her new book is out this week. It's called My Old Kentucky Home, The Astonishing Life and Reckoning of an Iconic American Song. It's published by Knopfler. And you've been working on this for a number of years, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I you know, had actually gave a talk about this over a decade ago to a small group of people, and I was really surprised. I mean, it was just something that has bothered me in the back of my head. As a parent, I wanted to sing the state song that I love the tune to my children. And as I started to do that, I began to wonder if that was really a good idea. Yeah. But I gave a talk about it to a small group. And after the talk, there were a couple of people who just raised their hands and said, I will never sing that song again. And then there were a couple of other people who happened to be have darker skin. And they said, we just had no idea you never knew.
Yeah.
How did you never know? Why have you all loved this song so much for so long? And I had never actually heard somebody Black talk about it. And what I realized is that in the course of researching, Black people have been talking about it and wrestling with this piece of American culture, this icon, for since it was published, and trying to find ways to put it to use to their benefit, protesting it, asking it to be revised, deleted, to be spared from it. And honest to God, nobody listened. Nobody, almost nobody ever listened.
Well, my favorite part of the book is, I'm from Bardstown. I grew up in Bardstown, is when you write about the song's connection to Bardstown. And for one thing, a lot of people think that the home that Foster refers to in My Old Kentucky Home is Federal Hill, the beautiful mansion that's still, that's a state park now, that still sits there. But he was actually talking about a slave cabin, wasn't he?
Right. So again, my friends who will look at the lyrics and just glance through them will see the only home or dwelling that is mentioned in those lyrics is a cabin. And there's a reference to young folks roll on the little cabin floor, all merry and happy and bright. And there's talk of the stereotyped pleasures of enslaved people by the old cabin door under moonlight singing. Yes. So that is the original sort of iconography or visual reference point, because absolutely, Foster was talking about plantations and slave life, not about white people's life on the plantation. That's not what Blackface Minstrelsy talked about. However, something interesting happened in the years between 1853 and the turn of the 20th century. And that very interesting, important thing was Jim Crow, the reconciliation after the Civil War of the white and white Southerners and white Northerners to let bygones be bygones and agree that it was okay to segregate, disfranchise, lynch, you know, even if it was unpleasant, keep Black people in their absolutely beleaguered place and continue to terrorize them. So in that sort of reunification and moving forward, it became very popular to celebrate the Old South and find it a point of interest and a place for tourists to explore. And especially plantations became a focus. And one tidbit that I came across that was astonishing to me is that the home in Bardstown that was became a public, you know, site for tourists to visit in 1923 is the first plantation house to open to the public that was not associated with a U.S. president. And in the years after 1923, in South Carolina, Georgia, Louisiana, there were these, you know, amazing, you know, public sites that did open and where people started to celebrate that heritage. And then you see it running through the culture of Gone with the Wind and countless movies and songs and books and, yes, including ones written here and so on. Yeah.
Well, growing up there, it was always murky as to whether or not Stephen Foster actually set foot on the property there. Perhaps he was aware of it, but you really couldn't find any evidence that, he was there, right?
I couldn't. Well, I couldn't, and neither could anybody else who's ever tried. There was a Kentucky writer who was talking about this problem in the 1930s of actually locating Stephen Foster there. And he said that he wished he could, when he got to heaven, he was going to ask, "Stevie, old boy, just one thing I would need to know. Where did you ever step foot in Bardstown, Kentucky?" And, you know, look, myths, we are full of myths in this country. Myths are, you know, part of how we make sense of the world, but we don't have to keep embracing them. And in this case, the myth probably grew out of one fact, which is Stephen Foster's much, much older sister did step foot in that house in Bardstown back in the 1830s when he was toddling around his own middle-class home in industrializing Pittsburgh. And she was on the marriage market and was, you know, trying to meet, you know, suitable gentlemen. And she actually made a connection. But that is the thread.
Well, sprinkled throughout the book are some personal experiences and your family's history as it relates to race and slavery and your experience with the song, your personal experience. You write about being descended from people, ancestors who were slave owners, of going to the Derby and shedding a tear during My Old Kentucky Home. What was it like going back and exploring your own past alongside that of this song and its legacy?
It wasn't particularly enjoyable. I didn't, you know, it's not a pleasure to take the veil off the, I don't know, I might say like a perfect record of progressivism that my family tried to promote in this state and for themselves. But we aren't perfect, and no one is. My ancestors were, again, living through a time of extreme prejudice and discrimination and persecution of certain groups of people. So it's really not surprising. However, I do want to be absolutely honest that we can move forward with truth. And I disclose, for instance, that my great-great-grandfather in North Carolina was a night rider with the Ku Klux Klan. I didn't know this until I was an adult. Nobody talked about this. And one legacy that I know this book is going to have, I hope it has many ripples, my children will never not know the way that their family, as progressive as it may have been on the Bingham side, did continue to perpetuate lies, prejudices. My great-grandfather, you know, said to a woman once who questioned him about lynching in the South that, you know, we would stop lynching them when they stopped attacking white women. And he knew better. That is not why Black men were lynched in this country. That was another myth that we have had to untangle. And that's just that's the work of being citizens to me.
So back to the song. In the book, you raise the question, can My Old Kentucky Home, is it redeemable? And you say no.
Well, here's a question I'd like to throw out to your listeners, Rick. In Germany, when people pour into stadiums to watch their favorite soccer team play, do they link arms and stand up and sing a song about the Holocaust? In South Africa, at cricket matches, do people, you know, get roused and emotional with a song about about apartheid? To me, it's not about getting rid of a song. It's about thinking about where it has come from and choosing where and when it belongs and whether it belongs in those places. And, you know, at a sporting event where we are excited, anticipatory, sentimental, celebrating tradition, this is the kind of tradition I think deserves a really long, hard look. It's not something to just push a button and stop. To me, it's something to sit with and contemplate. And I can guarantee you, nobody has ever told me that they stood up at the Kentucky Derby and thought about slavery, like contemplated slavery as they sang My Old Kentucky Home. If that's what the claim is, that somehow we should embrace, there's a time to think about slavery and sing songs that are against slavery. But I don't think these kind of settings that have been controlled by white leaders are the places to do that. I truly don't.
The name of the book is My Old Kentucky Home, The Astonishing Life and Reckoning of an Iconic American Song. Emily Bingham is the author. Emily, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's been such a pleasure.
Thanks to our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyrene Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, and Russell Wells. Bill Burton anchors our local newscast. Kojin Toshiro composed our opening and closing theme. And I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.